Hello and welcome to A History of Christian Theology. My name's Chad Kim. With me this week will be Tom Velasco and Trevor Adams. And going back to some of our roots, we're going to have a guest this week. So we haven't done this in quite some time, but it's always been fun to have some other voices join in the conversation. So we have my friend, the Reverend Dr. Drew Harmon, who was a friend of mine in seminary. And he went on to do his PhD, as I talk about in the podcast, at Marquette University in patristics. And now he serves as an Episcopal priest at a parish in North Carolina. So he's taking his wisdom gleaned from the church fathers and doing as they did, which most of them, almost all of them, were also priests and theologians, and the two tasks were never separated. We don't exactly talk about that proper, but Drew, I'm sure, could bring a lot to that conversation. So it's good to have him on. Yeah, we hope that you enjoy this conversation. We're going to talk about a book that Ambrose wrote that draws on some wisdom from Cicero, but applies it to the life of leading a church. So for what it was like for it was sort of an encouragement to pastors on the way that they should live and how they should serve their church. So there's a few of these kind of works that I would like to go through in our time in this podcast, but Chrysostom has one, and Gregory the Great has one. And Augustine sort of does as well. So there's a few of these texts out there where some of the church fathers have some stuff that I think is really good for ministers. So I hope that this is an encouragement to those of you out there who are drawing wisdom from the church fathers and serving the local church, because that is such a high and noble calling. So we appreciate that. It's been fun to interact with you, some of you all, on Facebook. I appreciated the encouragement and congratulations. I did finish my dissertation defense. If you're interested in hearing more about that, reading more about that, let me know. Appreciate all the encouragement. So it's fun to build this community of listeners. And hope that you enjoy this episode. Rate us, review us on iTunes, drop me a note, drop us a note. We love hearing from you all. And hope that you enjoy hearing from my friend Drew on Ambrose. Okay, well, so this week our podcast is going to be on Ambrose of Milan, and we chose to do his Deificis Ministrorum on the duties of the clergy. It's sometimes translated as So just for fun, I thought I would bring on a friend of mine who we met in seminary, and actually Drew is probably the best person I've ever seen at throwing a Frisbee. That might be the way that we met, and we did a lot of Ultimate Frisbee together, and you always wanted Drew to be your handler because I'd never seen someone throw what I guess ends up being forehand or backhand, I can't remember, but I'd never seen anyone be able to throw that way. And so that was how we met on the quad at seminary. But he ended up doing his PhD in patristics like I did, and we re-met up a few years ago at a conference, and he was doing Ambrose, and I thought, hey, this is a great time to have him on. And so he's an Episcopalian priest, a doctor of philosophy and historical theology, focusing on Ambrose and on his Trinitarian theology and virtue as well. So I guess we're going to bring him in to talk a little bit about his what he's written on and what he's researched. But the main subject of today is Ambrose. And as we've said, he is of Milan, so a 4th century priest. And he was the head of the church at Milan. And that's where, like, I know him basically as a my first thought is always he was the one who helped Augustine see the truth of the faith. So Augustine says in Book 6 that he learned from Ambrose how to read the scriptures at sort of a spiritual level. The letter kills, but the spirit gives life. And this key sort of unlocked Augustine's reading of the scriptures in the Old Testament. And so he went to go hear Ambrose just because he was a great rhetorician, and he didn't care about the faith at all. He was disaffected with his sort of Manichaean faith that he was a sort of related to a hearer, and he was sick of that, and went to go hear Ambrose when he took up his new post, and just slowly through Ambrose's teaching, came to the faith and was ultimately baptized at Milan. So that's kind of how I think of him. But of course, he's way more important than even just that. He's largely the one who created Christian hymnody. He was very important in sort of bringing together the insights of sort of Eastern Greek thought into the Western Latin world. So much more so than Augustine, he cites and reads the Greek Eastern theologians. So he's just a deep reservoir of insight and knowledge. And so so that's why we're going to do Ambrose. And this book is kind of cool because it is taken off of it's taken from Cicero. So Cicero wrote a book on duties. He wrote it to his son, and Ambrose writes it to his sons in the faith. And so it's sort of an interesting way to connect sort of how Christian authors took their classical sort of education and forebears and changed them slightly and sort of brought them into conversation with the divine philosophy, Christianity. And so I want to start right at the beginning. And as anybody knows me knows, I wrote my dissertation on humility in Augustine. And so I thought it was interesting. One of the first things that Ambrose brings out in his Duties on the Clergy, the first sentence is, "I think I shall not seem to be taking too much on myself if in the midst of my children I yield to my desire to teach, seeing that the master of humility himself has said, 'Come, ye children, hearken unto me, I will teach you the fear of the Lord,' wherein one may observe the humility and the grace of his reverence for God." And so he is speaking of Christ. Christ he calls the master, the teacher, the magister, of humility. And so that's how Ambrose departs on his project of talking about how bishops or how clergy should act. He says, first thing, they have to think about humility. And for me, this is surprising because, of course, Cicero in his De Officiis mentions the word humility only three times. And mostly they talk about people of humble or origin. And this is not a virtue. This is not a something that's necessarily good. It just means you're from the lower class. But Ambrose is one of the first to make this a, the beginning point of his on the clergy. So I guess my first question was, what is humility for Ambrose? So why do we think that this is so critical, for Ambrose?
Yeah, so can I jump
Yeah,
in?
sure, Drew, why don't you jump in?
Okay. Yeah, well, it's thanks for asking me to be a part of this. It's fun to have a conversation about someone that I spent a lot of time with and that kind of haunts my thoughts day in and day out. So as you mentioned, Ambrose does see Christ here as the master of humility. He's the one who sort of teaches all of those who would follow after how to be humble. And ultimately, less here in De Officiis, but more in his on the faith, his De Fide, he references Christ's humility with the Philippians hymn in Philippians 2, where Christ takes the form of a slave or a servant. So for Ambrose, we hear a lot in throughout De Officiis, especially toward the end of Book One. There's three books that comprise this work. Toward the end of Book One, we hear a lot about David's humility, King David's humility. We hear a lot about the Apostle Paul's humility. So what he's doing, I think, in part, is throwing different examples toward his hearers, toward his readers, so that they can think about the different ways in which humility has been enacted concretely in the lives of these sort of forebears in the faith. So the Apostle Paul, for instance, suffers persecution, but he endures that persecution with patience. He stays silent. Ambrose makes a big deal about silence over and over and over again, because I think, in part, He thinks about what we say and how we say it as telling of what is inside, what like the state of the soul, basically. And so to stay quiet, for instance, in the face of danger or difficulty or persecution, speaks to an equanimity, an even-tempered soul. Likewise, when King David is cursed, he stays silent. So there are different, these are sort of different postures that the humble ideally would take on. And in part, I think there's an aspect of providence behind all of this, of God being sort of in control of it all, that we can't change the things that are going on outside of us or that might even happen to us. Only God can change those things, but we can control how we act, how we react, and deal with them.
All right.
Tom, Trevor, any responses to the role of humility here?
Well, I think one thing also that, I don't know, I mean, at least it, I think it was referenced in the bit that I read last night, or maybe it was a footnote that I came across, but it's also somewhat reflective on his origins in the ministry, because Ambrose, of course, was kind of thrust into his position as bishop. He had only been a catechumen, I believe, when he was when he was first kind of given the position, which arose out of the fact that there was a dispute going on in the city between two different options, basically. One was, for the Bishop of Milan after the former bishop had either passed on or retired. I don't know exactly what happened, but there was a dispute between the Arians, who we talked about, of course, in the past pretty extensively. The Arians, for those of you guys who don't remember, are the followers of Arius who taught that Christ was not of the same substance as God, was not co-equal with God, but was a created being, the first created being, but nonetheless created. And so an Arian faction in the city were putting forward their own option, and there was the Catholic option being put forward, and the city was on the verge of a total meltdown, and rioting was breaking out, things of that nature. And Ambrose, who was a very popular low-level government official, was essentially the compromise choice. And so he had to kind of rush through his position as first catechumen, then he was baptized, then he went kind of through the ordinary steps to becoming a priest, a deacon, then a priest, and then finally a bishop. And so I think there was a real sense, and I don't know where over the course of his lifetime this particular work was written, but I think he had this sense also that he really had a lot of lost time to make up for, and that maybe readers wouldn't feel that he was particularly qualified to speak to these issues. And so I think, you know, maybe just, I mean, on the one hand, certainly an expression of actual humility, you know, on Ambrose's part. On the other hand, also, it also is kind of common form, as I think we've seen in the stuff we've been reading, that Christian writers in this period, I mean, we see it in Augustine, take great care to pay homage to humility, you know, to not, you know, appear to be proud or arrogant or anything like that. But also I think part of it is him making up for this lost time, and maybe also trying to make up for any loss of esteem he might have with some of his readers.
Interesting. I feel like I'm just learning listening to y'all, but but because I feel like I had a less deep takeaway, but I was just my takeaway was like simple in the sense that I just was struck by him saying that. I mean, maybe I'm putting words in Ambrose's mouth, but it felt like he was sort of saying, look, to teach, you really have to be just a really good student yourself in a way. Like the person who teaches has to learn, sort of be better at learning, you might say. And so maybe this just shows where I'm at in life, having to currently teach people. But what really struck me was that thought, because I was thinking to myself, I'm like, yeah, in a way it's a humble thing to teach, because, or it should be at least. I mean, a lot of people act like they're a really big deal, but because you sort of become like the ultimate student in order to teach some given subject. And it kind of tied in to the theme of keeping silent, which he does like never stop talking about. Seemed like, I don't know, felt like almost all this was about keeping silent, and that was the beginning of wisdom. And I'm like, all right. And it makes sense in the sense that you obviously, he thinks, right, you got to keep silent in order to learn, but you do have to just ingest so much more information on some given subject if you're to teach that subject than you'll ever actually teach. I've noticed mm-hmm. this like in preparing to teach something. You end up learning way more about it, and then you maybe impart, I don't know, 5% of everything you've learned to your students at best. Maybe I'm being already like really cynical, but it feels like you're just getting the bare minimum out there. But in a way, it's a humble thing in the sense that you submit yourself to the subject. That's right. Maybe that's not the way mm-hmm. people think of it, but maybe they think they're like mastering the subject or becoming its. Mm-hmm. But really, I don't know, especially in my field where people have been doing philosophy for like a million years, it feels like you're just trying to catch up in this really, 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 really long conversation. I imagine theology feels the exact same way, but I don't know, computer science is probably slightly different, but it's, so it's this sort of submit yourself to like the master, so to speak. And you just have to sit and you just need to learn. You need to become really well acquainted with this subject. And then you can maybe come to teach. But anyway, that was mostly what I gathered from the beginning of this work.
No, well, I think, go ahead.
I was just going to say, and it, just in response there, Trevor, it is a humbling thing I think anybody with a modicum of self-awareness to realize that people are listening to you and actually taking to heart what you're saying, like as in treating you like a teacher. You know, it seems hard to imagine how anybody could kind of look at the role of a teacher as like an earned right or something that, you know, everybody should just basically sit at my feet and listen. I think humility should be the initial response, because of course, hopefully every teacher would just be aware of how little he knows on the subject and how astonishing it is that people have come to listen to him or her.
Right.
Drew, you were going to add something?
Yeah, I was just going to add, I think both of Tom and Trevor's reflections here, I think you're spot on. You're definitely onto something, because Ambrose, I mean, he was a public official prior to being acclaimed bishop in 374. And he was only in that public official position for about 2 years prior to becoming bishop. And as is pretty well documented, he was a catechumen in the faith. So he was not, and he was not yet baptized when he was acclaimed bishop. So there's an old story that he was baptized, confirmed, ordained, and elected bishop in the span of 8 days, which, you know, you can take that with a grain of salt or not. But in any respect, I think that sort of is telling of how he felt unprepared. Now, this work, De Officiis, is dated typically to around the 390s. So he's been bishop at this point, you know, say 15 years or so. So, you know, you kind of balance his experience at this point with the statements of humility. But at the same time, I do think, you know, he's reflecting on being sort of snatched from his public offices and being made bishop, you know, forced to be in charge of the church and the functional capital of the Roman Empire at this point. So he's, you know, he's in a position he's constantly on display before people. And so I think you do see throughout his writings, especially here, but in other writings as well, that he is completely infatuated with what people think. I mean, there are records of him editing his sermons before they were disseminated. And so there is, you know, one scholar said that he has an obsession with how he presents himself, with what people see. And, you know, as a trained government official, and then as a person, placed in, you know, in a high visibility, profession, I think it would be impossible to say that he's not constantly aware of how he's coming across to people, and how prepared or underprepared he is in whatever he's seeking to do or preach.
That's great. I mean, just to sort of summarize, you know, some of the things that he says right here in this first page, for one is the true master, who alone has not learned what he taught all. But men learn before they teach and receive from him what they may hand on to others. So we have this sense. That just one down from there. So it happened that I began to teach before I began to learn. Therefore, I must learn and teach at the same time, since I had no leisure to learn before. And so we also have this sense, and the same Augustine basically has a very similar way of describing humility. That is, that you have to be willing to receive first before you can pass down the faith, right? So he wrote a book on the usefulness of believing, De Utilitate Credendi. And, you know, there's sort of, for Augustine, in a way, you could say this is sort of the bedrock of what it means to do theology. Credo ut intelligam, I believe, I trust, I submit in a way in order that I might understand. And so there is some connection in my mind between how he describes the necessity of receiving first before you can teach, and sort of the difficulty of, say, like Christ says, as Augustine is wont to quote, that there, you have one teacher. There is one teacher in heaven, and, you know, we have to learn from him. And so there is, you know, that's, I think, part of what Ambrose is drawing on here. It also reminds me that Seneca said, docendo discimus, by teaching we learn, and which is, you know, sometimes Latin can get those phrases really tight. And that's one of my favorite ones as a teacher. So there's a good connection to this. I guess we should lay out sort of overall what happens in these books. So he has, this is basically in three major sections, and he follows very closely what Cicero says, and how Cicero lays out his work on De Officiis, although he will do some very different things from Cicero. He basically agrees that there are duties that are ordinary, and then there are duties that are quote unquote perfect, that are like complete, and then there are sort of also useful duties. And then at the end, he tries to bring together both of these things that are useful and honorable, and to try to make sort of the complete person. And it's, you know, in that regard, he looks a whole lot like Cicero. And then he talks about the standard classical virtues, so prudence, or wisdom, justice, fortitude, bravery, and temperance or moderation. And he sort of treats of those. So in that respect, he's very much like Cicero. And he just sort of seems like he's passing on kind of broader Roman traditional virtue. So my question is always, when I'm looking at this stuff from antiquity, is like, you know, to what extent are these Christian authors just sort of receiving from their classical forebears? And what ways are they changing it? Are they adapting it? So how, I guess my question would be, what are ways in which Ambrose sort of borrows, and is he just borrowing wholesale? Like, is that, I mean, as a Christian, is that problematic? I mean, this is another way of getting at the sort of standard question that we talk about a lot, but, like, you know, they're kind of inundated in this classical culture. And, you know, Christians have to sort of say, okay, do we just sort of accept all of that wholesale? And or do we modify it? How much do we modify it? How much is being sort of too reliant on culture? So that's kind of the direction that I wanted to head next. I'll just open it up there. Anybody want to jump in?
Well, I think, you know, this is a question I think that's come up a lot for us. And I think it comes up a lot because I think we all have to wrestle with it, right? You know, I think there's long existed this tension within the church, you know, this that is rooted in the desire to not be, you know, quote, of this world, end quote, to, you know, when you look at the things of the world culturally, academically, and, you know, entertainment wise, I think there can be a tendency to kind of look at, you know, some of those things and fear that to take part would be to, in some sense, you know, become complicit with the devil or something like that. And I think that vein pops up all throughout church history. You know, the passage that I read last night that really sticks out to me, and there was a lot that I think Ambrose wrote on the subject. Obviously, he's bringing much from pagan literature. You know, he brings up the four virtues, which were recognized, you know, traditionally by the pagans, or by, you know, the Greek pagans and Roman pagans. And he talks extensively about them and tries to defend, you know, scripturally, the fact that these four virtues are appropriate for Christians to revere. But there's one passage in particular that strikes me, and it's when he's talking about eloquence and speaking beautifully. And he talks about jests, joking. And he makes the claim that essentially a preacher should never jest. It was one of those ones that I made a note on in the book. I said, really? I mean, there are certain things that when I read, I just, you know, I see this antipathy towards the culture or towards, you know, the world, again, to kind of come back to that terminology. And I don't know, I just don't understand why anybody would feel the need to not joke, that joking is in some sense bad. I mean, if he'd qualified it maybe with, like, you know, no coarse jesting or something like that, but he even acknowledges that jesting might not be evil. It's just something that should be beneath the minister. And so I just found that, I mean, that's one of a few reactions that he had that, that kind of, you know, hit me regarding this topic. But I don't know, what do you guys, any thoughts on that? It was just kind of a funny little thing.
Yeah, I'll jump in here. I do think it's interesting that you pick up on the joking thing. As a person who writes sermons frequently, you know, I go back and forth, you know, as to how much I want people to laugh or not. you know, but in any respect, I think for Ambrose here that there is he's trying in part to create a sort of store of exemplars of faith, and he's doing that, I think, in contradistinction, you know, in juxtaposition to what Cicero is offering. Now he admits. He uses, you know, a lot of what Cicero has written, what he's been handed down, and he uses a lot of what other people have handed down. I mean, he's been called a plagiarist, a blatant plagiarist, and you know, some have called Deificis a monstrosity of ethics, because he's sort of he's sort of patchworking things together. In some respects. So, but what I do think he is trying to do, through the scriptural interpretations that he's been handed, especially from the Greek tradition, is that he's trying to show that these examples of faith, these patriarchs and matriarchs of the faith, are as praiseworthy, and worthy of imitation, as the sort of classical examples, if not more so. And in fact, he argues, you know, typically these examples from faith are more excellent, they're more remarkable. You know, he makes the claim repeatedly that they're older, that they're more ancient, that, you know, that they would have more purchase for people because they're not derived or stolen or something like that. These are the sort of original, original representations of virtue and moral excellence. And so I think part of what he's getting at when he's doing all of this is he's trying to create a store of a canon of moral of examples of moral excellence for people for people, but especially for new or soon to be ordained priests to take to heart, in distinction from what they might see, you know, outside the walls of the church. This is not to say that he doesn't find, you know, things beneficial with classical literature or classical examples. I think it'd be hard to argue that that was the case, but I think he's trying to make the case that that Christianity has a culture, and that these examples are a way of sort of laying out that culture and that history. And in some respects, it's an alternative history to what people might have seen previously.
Yeah, that brings to mind maybe a worry. Well, I don't know if I'm worried about it. It's a question I've thought about before, though, is to what extent Christianity has a culture. Now, I know that sounds mm-hmm. crazy, but I grew up like in a evangelical culture, so then it certainly felt like we had a culture because we had our own music and mm-hmm. You know, our own bad movies. The music was, some of it was bad too, but some of it was, you know, was palatable. I still listen to Reliant K to this day, but the point is, there's a sense in which, when I, at least as I've been reading for this podcast, and this is the first time I've read most of this stuff, I'm like, oh wow, they really liked, you know, Greek and Roman philosophy. Great, because of course I like philosophy, so I'm like, I'm totally okay with them borrowing from, sort of like Western philosophy in that way. And I'm like, oh yeah, this is all good and this is fine. In fact, they should be doing this. This is great, only because I've been forced to read a lot of this stuff and I like it. So, but I never thought about the way in which Christianity actually like formed cultures within the cultures they were already in. And the first cultural division I could think about was the East-West division that ends up happening. And it seems like, when you look at, for example, Orthodoxy in the East, it certainly has taken on parts of the Eastern mindset, you might say, and focuses more on Eastern philosophy. And similarly, Western philosophy ends up becoming like hardcore Aristotelian in the church, that is. And I was wondering to myself, like, have we really just actually move past just sort of assimilating the culture in? Because I'm thinking about American Christianity now, and there's certainly parts of it that are distinctly American, and yet we're somehow also trying to create a culture. So maybe there's just a tension here. Like, I think we want there to be a Christian culture that's sort of common to all, but it's actually hard for me to think about what the Christian culture is that would be common to all, especially since it doesn't seem like anyone would agree to what standard to what the standard would be for the Christian culture. I don't know.
Well, that was, I mean, one reason that I always bring up humility is there are analogs in classical culture. Like, you can find some discussion of the need to be humble. For the most, you see, don't be like hubris is a vice. And I mean, even Cicero will talk about don't be arrogant. But there's not the like in a sort of like the opposite of the golden mean. There's sort of one extreme that's to be feared, but it's the other one is not discussed or valued at all, which is humility, or at least I should say not at all, but minimally. It is minimally praised in the way that it is in Christianity. So that was one that I brought up that Ambrose starts off with. The need for silence, the need for humility, the need for teachability, those things I took to be sort of fairly unique for Christians as they, as they sort of develop something of their own culture. I mean, I take your point, Trevor, that there's got to be some difference across even Christianity in East and West and North and South. You know, I mean, there's going to be things that are different from one to the other. But nevertheless, I think humility is one that's an interesting one. I mean, Augustine called it the ground of the virtues, and said that that was something that you needed to begin with in order to get started on utilizing the other or practicing the other virtues.
Now that you say that, it actually makes me think maybe I am so encultured by the culture I grew up in that I didn't even really think about it. But it does seem like I do like cringe at like braggadocious behavior. You know, I do find it cringy when people are willing to say like really congratulatory things about themselves. But I've never attributed that to Christian culture, but maybe it is. I'm not really sure. But you do hear it is pounded into your head growing up, you know, first or the last shall be first and the first shall be last. And like all these messages about sort of not putting yourself above and don't seat yourself at the best seat at the table, but let the master of the house seat you there. Or whatever. I mean, there was so many like messages that are essentially like be humble. But I hadn't really. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe I was attributing that to American culture, which now sounds really stupid to say out loud. So.
Well, especially when you think of the fact that, and I know that there are some translational issues. I've had I had a professor who translated it differently in the Nicomachean Ethics, but my version of the Nicomachean Ethics that I used in school, Aristotle's work, translated the word as pride as being one of the virtues, right? And I really do think that there was this sense that, and I'm still not super clear on how the Greeks understood that word. And I don't know offhand what Greek word was translated as pride, but nonetheless, it's something that I know's, or that I've heard taught about kind of Greek philosophers, Greek culture, Greek thinking, was that there was this sense that a person should be very self-aware of his capabilities and very confident, and having that, that it would be a kind of a help to him living a good and comfortable life, and it would contribute to his worthiness as a person. One of the things that it seems to me that I've picked up on with some of these writers like Ambrose and Augustine and, you know, others who are interacting with Greek culture is I think they're challenging that idea a bit and trying to say, look, that pride is actually not a virtue. And we're substituting this other idea, which does seem to be somewhat foreign to the Greeks of the day. This idea that you can be humble without being self-effacing, and without being that you could be meek without being weak. Maybe would be another way to kind of think about it. That the Greeks had a tendency, I think, and I think a lot of people do, to make that fundamental mistake, to mistake humility and meekness for being self-effacing or being self-loathing and weak. And it seems like some of these Christian writers are challenging that part of the culture. I don't know. That's been my assessment of it. I don't know. It's hard for me to exactly say because I just, you know, have interacted with it a few times and I recall that in reading the Ethics, but I don't know. Any thoughts on that?
Drew, I don't know if you have any response here. You haven't chimed in a minute.
Well, I wanted to, so I don't have a response to that initially because I was thinking about something else, but I just think it, I think it would be helpful to note that in establishing, we talk about establishing a particular kind of culture, that at this time also has social and political purchase, right? It's not just for the sake of making our own unique expression of church, but as Christianity is spreading throughout the Roman Empire, as you're having fights between Arians and Catholics, or different sects or factions within within the church. I mean, to say that you're establishing a culture that privileges a certain way of speaking or thinking or believing, however you want to put that, is in part a way arguing for it has a sort of apologetic function in certain respects. Like you're prizing, a Catholic expression of Christianity, which is there are necessarily all these things indexed within that over and against an Arian understanding or a non-Catholic understanding that might have all of these other things, whether or not all of those qualities are actually present, whether or not Arians walk funny or make too many jokes when they speak or whatever it is. I think in part the establishing of culture is for the sake of a particular an understanding of the Catholic faith here for Ambrose. So he sees it as this is the lifeline of the church. Like this is, if we're going to further this along, if we're going to fight off error or dissension or social unrest, even we need to priests should do these things. The faithful should, act in these ways or speak in these ways for that. So as much as it's a sort of like theological issue, it's also a social and political issue, especially here. Now I think conversations of Christianity and culture today in the United States, I mean, certainly, have social and political sort of themes to them as well. But in Ambrose's time, I think it's slightly different because we're not living amidst 4th century Roman Empire. And while there are dissenting factions within the church, it's not quite the same as what we had back then. So that's just kind of what I wanted to throw into the mix there.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know the word in the Nicomachean Ethics for pride. But yeah, I mean, it's sort of interesting as sort of an antidote that Christians propose humility. And as as we've already quoted, like I mean, this comes straight from Christ, right? So he's the great hero of the Christian faith, the greatest exemplar is one who dies on behalf of others. And just as we're sort of talking about things in unique Christian culture. So it made me think of a few different sort of interesting, practices or mores or ideas that Ambrose has. And he's such a curious figure. As we've already said, he is first sort of a public official. That was sort of his first job. And then he gets thrust into the church. But in his so he sort of has his feet in both camps. But he's a very distinctly and sort of uniquely committed person to the church by the time of the writing of the Deo Fictis, in that he's writing things that would, seemingly, well, and did at various times, right? So there's the famous story about him coming up with the hymns while he was under threat from armies that were led, that were sent to take over his church by the Arian emperor. So over the course of his life, there were various emperors of different sort of Christian or pseudo-Christian persuasions. There were some that were sort of committed to Nicene Christianity for the Council of Nicaea. There were some who were Arian, who were pro-Arian, that there was a time when Christ was not. And then even I guess within his life is also Julian the Apostate. And so, you know, Ambrose has his life spans a lot of different cultural winds and changes. But he does these things that are like totally sort of unique and place the church sort of outside the winds of culture, where he talks about buying back captives and some of he brings down the hatred. He says on so in book two, chapter 28, he talks about, "I brought odium on myself, hatred on myself, because I broke up the sacred vessels to redeem captives, a fact that could displease the Arians." And so, like, I just, you know, there are some of these other things that Ambrose proposes that are pretty radical, selling the gold from the temples in order to buy back captives. So, and then he talks in another place about how you can't respond to a robber who comes into your house and breaks in. You're not supposed to return blows to the robber. Lest in defending his life, he should stain his love towards his neighbor. I mean, Augustine takes, or excuse me, Ambrose takes the Beatitudes and his role as a minister so seriously that he's willing to sort of stick his neck out in the midst of geopolitical conflicts. And say, look, it's our job as the church to be the support of those who are captive, who are poor, who are, you know, otherwise marginalized. Like, some of these things are super radical. And, I was totally unfamiliar with this idea of selling the valued vessels of the church until, well, the only other instance that I'm aware of was I was doing some reading on Caesarius of Arles, who's a priest in Gaul. In the fifth century, in the later fifth century, and he does the same thing. I don't know if he's read Ambrose or not, but Ambrose, and this is another point that we'll bring up later, but Ambrose is read throughout the Middle Ages, this work especially, for what a priest sort of should do, a leader in the church should do. So he has these like radical proposals. I don't know. I was just sort of like, on the one hand, you could look and say that a government official who's also a priest is going to be just sort of a sycophant for the state. But that's clearly not what Ambrose has in mind.
Well, not only is he not a sycophant for the state, right? I mean, what some people think is kind of like the pinnacle, or I don't know if pinnacle is the right word, but the moment when, symbolically, the Roman state hands power to the church comes when Ambrose refuses to give communion to the Emperor Theodosius, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, at that moment, a lot of people look at that, at least symbolically, as the transition from state power to church power, which will, of course, inform the Middle Ages.
So I got off on kind of a tangent looking up Aquinas's virtues, and which one would end up getting connected to Blessed Are the Meek. And it seems like it's actually going to be temperance for him out of the four cardinal virtues, since he connects it to, like, a lack of meekness is a disorder in your passions. And so in order to like overcome them, you need temperance, and thus that's how you become meek. So was that connected to anything that was said? No. But did I find it interesting? Yes.
Yeah, so. Trevor really likes us to go down tangents on Aquinas.
It got me to make it somewhat more broad. What interested me is how I was sitting there, and like from everything that was said, I was like, wow, man, humility really is like this uniquely Christian passion. I'm like, so Aquinas must have talked about it. So then I had to go look for where it was in Aquinas, because I was like, there's no way Aquinas has overlooked this. So.
Yeah, it'll be many years before we get to Aquinas, but we will have Aquinas bit.
We'll get to it. We will get to it.
I know. I'm sorry.
No, but yeah. So anyway, that was one of the big things that I wanted to bring out. Like, just, I mean, can you imagine, in a lot of our churches today, like going in and saying, all right, let's sell the sound system. We've got people who are, we've got Christians that we need to save. I mean, I know there's got to be a balance on some of this stuff. I can remember in seminary, we talked about whether or not that a church should raise money to replace the organ if it was going to be sometimes these organs in these old churches will cost tens of thousands of dollars. And there was sort of like this like sort of practical question, should the church continue to use these things when there are people who are sick and suffering and especially other Christians? And Ambrose at least says in some cases, I mean, this line alone, I just can't even like the glory of the sacraments is the redemption of captives. He says that when he's talking about like using the vessels that are offered, that offer the blood and the wine, the most glorious ways to use those vessels is not only to offer the sacraments, but also to melt them down and redeem the captives. I mean, like what a beautiful way of thinking about what we do as a church, like combining the sacrament and its effort and its power as well to do some real world transformation.
I mean, there's a striking balance here of someone who is in an incredibly public space, an incredibly public position, doing something that the majority of the public would not agree with or find very strange or odd. And you see this too, like when Augustine in his Confessions talks about encountering Ambrose. I mean, there was a crowd around Ambrose, like people were fascinated by him. You know, they couldn't get enough of what he was saying and how beautiful his rhetoric was and how eloquent he was and all of these different things. But then at the same time, Augustine talks about Ambrose. He kind of has a soft spot for the Greeks, for the Psalms, or the commentary on the Song of Songs, and he reads to himself, like he doesn't read out loud, which he finds utterly strange. And so, there's this balance, this back and forth between someone who is incredibly public and on display, but also has a real has a heart for people that goes beyond something that's just political, I think. I think that's one of the reasons why Ambrose is considered such a sort of curious personality in the history of the church. It's why some are frustrated by him, because maybe he's not pious enough, and then other people think he's sort of feigning piety altogether in the ways that he writes. And anyway, all that to say, it's this really interesting juxtaposition of someone who is on display and also deeply, deeply aware of what goes on when people aren't looking.
Hey, Drew, I got a question for you. Based off what you just said, this is actually something that struck me because, I've mentioned a couple of historical, references to Ambrose, things that I studied back in my school days. But I actually don't know a lot overall about his kind of life. I mean, his story arc. I mean, I know, of course, what Augustine mentions in the Confessions, but in addition to what I just mentioned. But I think it's funny. I teach at a school which is called the Ambrose School. And at the Ambrose School, they always, I don't know, not always, but they often will include some kind of a written blurb or a short, presentation on Ambrose's life, and they'll extol his piety or something along those lines. And I don't know whether he was pious or not. I actually just don't know much about him as an individual, independent of, those couple of anecdotes that I shared and what was mentioned in Augustine. Is there any insights you could share on him in that sense?
He is a sort of curious figure. I mean, he's sort of on the edge of this budding elite class. His father was a government official and died soon after he was born. Ambrose has an older brother and sister. His brother dies, and he writes this beautiful two-book elegy to him. His sister was a nun. And anyway, so he goes, he's born in Trier in modern day Germany and goes to Rome for education. And he's sort of classically trained, as you see evinced in, you know, his writings. And from that point on, it sort of enters public life of public service, but that only that only lasts for a couple of years, and then he's thrust into church duties and church administration. So he's interesting because of this sort of hurried timeline into the church. He leans a lot on different sources, and so I mentioned earlier that he's often deemed a plagiarizer. Like Didymus the Blind, who's a Greek writing around the same time, accuses him of being a crow in another's plumage, you know, and Jerome just had so many like negative things to say about Ambrose, just thought he basically was a fraud. You know, he relied way too much on what other people had said and didn't say anything unique in and of himself. And so there's, you know, from his contemporaries to, you know, to modern day scholarship, there's this debate as to whether or not he just sort of aggregates things that sound good, or if he really did much in the way of writing theology and spirituality. It's an ongoing debate and conversation. You know, most modern scholars of Ambrose will say, no, in fact, you know, there's some real texture to his theology, to what he has to say. There's some meat to this. If you look at the way in which he assembles sources, if you look sort of between the lines, we can gain a lot about what he thought was important, what he thinks people of faith should take away. For me, one of the main sort of lasting things is the ways in which he bridges the Greek and the Latin traditions. You know, he's fluent in Greek, and he has facility with all of these Greek sources like Origen, Philo of Alexandria, and he's bringing that and a lot of that and those lines of biblical interpretation into the West. And you see that carried through some in Augustine and some, you know, as Ambrose is widely disseminated, some into the Middle Ages. So his work, at least in that respect, as a bridge builder that makes available Greek resources to a Latin world, to a Latin West, is pretty significant, I think. And within those resources, within Origen and Philo, you see there's a huge emphasis on the on biblical exemplars, which you see here in Deificis, and the importance of seeing the virtues enacted and lived out in the stories taken from the Hebrew scriptures and also from the Christian scriptures and early church history.
How interesting and a bit ironic that Jerome has such disdain for him. As I don't know, I always think of Jerome paired with Ambrose. You know, when people talk about the four doctors of the Western Church being mm-hmm. Ambrose, Augustine, Jerome, and Gregory the First. So I think it's mm-hmm. interesting that I didn't realize that he had that kind of those kinds of issues with him. I guess interesting. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was, Drew was sort of at the very end there. I noticed I read an article that he's written in the Journal of Early Christian Studies. And this is just a side point. I got through it and I was like, man, I think I had that many footnotes in the first chapter of my dissertation, maybe. or the first two chapters even. Drew is like carefully footnoted everything that he just said in several minutes. If you want to know precise sources for every one of those short sentences, he has them all in his article. At some point I was like, I mean, I think it's like two or three sentences on the top and then just all footnotes.
This is an example of how you shouldn't write, right?
No, I mean, it's just, well, my thought was it's a very well researched piece. But I was always sort of daunted by that stuff, or still am. I'm like, man, I don't have enough footnotes in this. Got to go back to the drawing board.
Yeah, that's one of the benefits of Ambrose. I mean, he himself footnotes people left and right. And so, if you're going to do justice to citing him, you know, you're sort of bound to cite all these other people too, which makes for an interesting, you know, research project because, you know, all of a sudden you find yourself researching something you couldn't or hadn't anticipated researching, and reading all this random secondary literature. So
also ironic that an accused plagiarizer would be so good at footnoting.
Oh, well, he's not, but all the sort of French and German scholars are. So
no, I know. I was just
yeah.
Well, I want to. I told Drew that we usually go about an hour, so I don't know if you we can let you. I had one more question that I kind of wanted to, because Drew is a pastor. Do you have time for one more question?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. So the last question that I sent you all that I was thinking about, and Tom just mentioned Gregory the Great, Gregory the First, when I read The Pastoral Rule. I just thought this is an amazing book. I wish every pastor read The Pastoral Rule. And I was thinking about this as I was reading these on the duties of the clergy. So as I understand it, it was used and translated for ministers in the medieval church. So it did have a pretty long afterlife. But I was just thinking, and Tom's a pastor as well. Would you assign this book if you were at a seminary and you thought about, like, you know, integral texts for, like, training ministers that kind of come down through church history, would you put this up there? Like, this is must read for future ministers or practicing ministers. Or maybe, and even alongside that, like, what, if you think so, like, what things did you, like, that stuck out to you that, like, we don't talk about this enough? Or vice versa, like, yeah, why are we? Well, Tom's already mentioned one, but, like, okay, this whole thing about not joking, like, you know, okay, we can leave that to a side. My response to that was, I tend to think that Augustine was pretty funny, and clearly did not follow that advice. But aside from that, so I guess we could start. Tom, did you have a thought from what you've looked at this? Some, like, would you assign this for pastors?
Like I said to you guys earlier, I haven't read enough of it. I can say that there were moments of the bit that I did read, in which I rolled my eyes, kind of like the comment about jesting. And really those moments where I felt he was just, I don't know where, and I didn't really blame him. It's something that has just been such a part of the church, but where I felt the, just the reaction against so many things that were not distinctly and specifically scriptural or Christian, just were troubling and bothersome to me. But there was also in what I read quite a bit that was profound and moving. And so what I've read so far, and I'm actually glad that we'll be ending soon because I want to finish it and I'd like to come back and retackle more of it next week if you guys are okay with that. But what I'm, you know, but yes, from what I've read so far, I would definitely feel comfortable recommending this to people who were interested in going into ministry.
Yeah, I think I'm a little biased here, obviously, because I've spent some time with Ambrose, but I do think that. That it's beneficial in a number of respects, I think. I mean, as we kind of hinted at earlier, it opens up conversations of Christian conversations with philosophy or with non-Christian thought. And I think whether or not we agree with the manner in which Ambrose goes about it, I mean, I think that it provides a springboard into those discussions. And I also think that, you know, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, like Ambrose bringing in the Greek scriptural exegesis into his thinking and the ways in which he writes and preaches, I think, is significant. I mean, it's significant. We can look at him as a sort of as a compiler of sources, as a person who, as a footnoter, as someone who relies deeply on the value, the worth of the tradition that preceded him. And I think that that can go a long way in training and forming people for service in the church. I mean, you know, taking the posture of one who learns first before he or she goes out and teaches, I think is significant. And while it might be simple and it might be sort of given as being part of, church teaching, I do think that that it can go a long way in shaping and forming generations of leaders in the church.
Yeah. Trevor, thoughts?
I feel completely unqualified to say anything about this. But I liked reading it, so, and I like the philosophy and the connection to it. So, I mean, I give this like 1.5 thumbs up. Something like that.
All right.
Nice. Thumbs up.
Well, in the interest of time, I think we'll bring this episode to a close. So I'll just while we're still on the air, I'll thank Drew for taking an hour or two out of his day. I had to talk to him for about 45 minutes because I can't shut up. But earlier this week, but yeah, so he's taken a few hours for this podcast this week. So I appreciate that. And his wife and family letting us learn from him and his knowledge of Ambrose. So thanks, Drew.
Yeah, thanks Drew.
Guys.
Yeah,
thanks.
Yeah, Drew. It was nice to have you on.
Yeah, it was great to be with you all. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to History of Christian Theology. We'll be back next week with an episode of Africans Against the World, and we may still try to do one more episode with Drew, but as of right now, that's a little bit on hold. I also have another interview that should be coming up here in the next week or so. Thank you very much for listening. We'll talk to you next week.